there's something very peculiar about Sanskritic traditions, and that is that you can read works from the 17th century, when almost the entirety of the subcontinent is ruled by the Mughals. So you have Islamic rule there, where there's quite a substantial Muslim population in the subcontinent. You can read text from areas where, you know, up to a third of the population are actually Muslims, Indian Muslims, people who converted to Islam often generations before them. And you read those texts, and there's hardly any mention of Islam in there, and of Muslims. And if there is mention of it, there would be mention of Muslims, but not of Islamic theology as such. And it's something very peculiar about Sanskrit traditions, about Sanskrit learning, that in a sense the debates that have been going on for centuries are carried on up until the 18th century with little change. And so some of these debates, they started in the sort of the early centuries AD, and they continue on. But in the early centuries AD, there's a strong Buddhist presence in the subcontinent. And by the 18th century, there's hardly any Buddhists left. But 18th century authors will continue to refute Buddhist ideas, but will not mention Islamic ideas in any way. And so it's kind of, it's this, you can read some of these Sanskrit texts, you can read texts of Ramanuja's tradition, for example, or of Shankara's tradition, or of Shaiva Siddhanta, and so on, from periods, from the last couple of centuries, and you would get the impression that there are no Muslims in India. And now, there's various reasons why that might be the case, and various scholars have dealt with that to a lesser and greater degree. But it's something of the nature of Sanskrit traditions, in that they're inherently conservative in the way they see themselves. They're kind of carrying on these age-old debates, and even if there's no Buddhists around, it's still worthy refuting Buddhist ideas, because it's about the ideas, in a sense, and it sort of matters little whether there are actually Buddhists around who can sort of argue back and refute your refutation of them. Now, there are Hindu texts and Hindu traditions that do mention Muslims extensively, and that do engage to some degree with Islam, and in a theological sense, sort of Islamic theology and Islamic practice. But those will be vernacular texts. And so what we'll be looking at today is a group of individuals who are often grouped together under the rubric of sants. A sant literally is a saint, is a good person, a true person. And they're a group of poets writing in the vernacular in North India, from the, say, 14th century onwards. And in their writings, not only is there a noticeable influence of some Islamic ideas, but there is also constant reference to Muslims. And as we will see, a number of those individuals come from Islamic, from Muslim backgrounds, and walk on the boundary between Islam and Hindu ideas, as we will see. Now, it's perhaps no coincidence that in the writings of these poets, we also find some of the earliest references to the notion of a Hindu identity. And as we will see, in a lot of these poems, there's a constant reference not just to Islam, to Muslims, who are called variously, who are called Yavana, which is actually Greek, who are called Mlecha, which is barbarian, basically sort of the well, what barbarians are for Greek, sort of thing. Lecce is kind of the equivalent of that. And you often get the word Turk, Turkish people. And these are the terms that are used in Hindu texts to refer to Islamic, to Muslims. The Yavanas is a term that is used in Sanskrit texts very early on to refer to Greeks. Alexander the Great sort of marched to India, conquered part of sort of the northwestern subcontinent, and there was a sizable Greek population there at the time, or people who spoke Greek, and they're referred to in Sanskrit texts as Yavanas. But it's a term that by the 14th century comes to be used to refer to Muslims in India. And it's one of the, I mean, you can sort of see it in the way Muslims are referred to. The Muslims that are referred to are Muslims, or Indian Muslims, are Muslims that, you know, are of Indian ethnicity, their ancestors are from India, but they're constantly referred to by terms that sort of refer to their foreignness, in a sense, to their Greekness, or, I mean, not that these are Greeks, but the Greek kind of just comes to be used as foreigner, which then comes to be equated with that, or their Turkish background, which is a lot of Muslim rulers have a Turkish background, or Turkic background, and Lecce as kind of the barbarian. And it kind of, in a sense, what the terms illustrate is there's sort of a foreignness to Islam, which is kind of part of why Sanskritic cultures don't engage with it in very much. And, you know, there is a brahminical norms of purity prevent you from, if you're a Brahmin, from engaging with non-Brahmins. There's restriction on that, specifically then with people who are outside of the Varna system, which these people by definition are. And so there's sort of a lack of engagement there because they're seen as much as barbarians, as sort of people who are outside of the fold of the Dharma Shastras and so on. And therefore there's little engagement with that. On the other hand, we do know that a lot of Brahmins did work at Muslim courts. And the Muslim courts, like Hindu courts or before them and at the same time, gather scholars around them, including Brahmin scholars who produce works on various topics and so on. So it's not that they're entirely sort of aloof from them and have no interaction with them whatsoever as sort of a group. But we do kind of see the sort of the attitudes are reflected in the way they refer to. But as we will see, at the same time as we find these references in the poetry of the Sans to Yavanas and Lechas and Turks, and we find they're completely contrasted with another group, the Hindus. And if you remember from last term, when we looked at the notion of what is Hinduism, how can we define Hinduism, we talked a bit about that. And it's here we find the term Hindu used in quite a sort of a broad sense to refer to a group of traditions and specifically sets of practices that people follow, as we will see in some of the poems we'll read later, that can be separated from the Muslims. And that are sort of distinct. There is no Hinduism here. There is no sense that there is a unified doctrine that ties all the Hindus together. But there's a sense of we share certain practices that are different from Islamic practices, from the practices that Muslims have. And so this is kind of what you see emerging here in this period, a stronger sense of there are differences among these different traditions that we now call Hindu, but there's something that unites them, that sort of they share with each other in distinction with Islam. You will normally not find a reference, or you will not find the term Hindu used in and of itself. It will always be Hindus and Turks, Hindus and Yavanas, Hindus and Lechas, and so on. So it's always in contrast with these groups. Now, the people that we will look at, and particularly the main person we will look at is an individual called Kabir, are sort of in between those two, or you know, we sort of think of them as Hindu, but as we will see, a lot of these poets are saying we're neither Hindus nor Muslims, and these distinctions between Hindus and Muslims are distinctions that, you know, the pundits of the Hindus and the qazis and the mullahs of the Muslims have come up with, but really there is no such thing as Hindu and Muslim. That's a very superficial understanding of the nature of these of religion, of understanding God, and this is particularly true of someone like Kabir, who comes from a Muslim background, is said to have been initiated into a Hindu tradition by an individual called Ramananda, who is a fairly obscure figure in the sense that we know very little about him. This Ramananda, who is said to be the guru of Kabir, is often said to be linked to the tradition of Ramanuja. But where Ramanuja's focus is on the worship of Vishnu, as we've seen, Ramananda's worship is focused on Ram. Ramananda is a very important figure for the North Indian devotional traditions because of the order that is said to go back to him, which is the order of the Ramanandis, which is an important, predominantly ascetic order that still is quite prominent and that sort of is very influential in the development of bhakti in general, and specifically Ram bhakti, devotion to Ram in North India. But Ramananda is a figure that a lot of the sants who we'll see are theologically are very diverse and a little difficult to sort of find or in a sense kind of grouped in some ways artificially together. A lot of the sants are said to be disciples of Ramananda, or there's sort of a link made, or with disciples of Ramananda, and so on. And the story goes with Kabir that Kabir wanted to be initiated by Ramananda, but Ramananda, being a Brahmin, said, "Well, I cannot initiate you. You're a weaver, which is a low caste, and then of recently converted to Islam." And he says, I can't initiate you, you're unclean, and so on. And the story goes that Kabir, this is in Benares, that Kabir in the morning prostrated himself on the steps of the ghat leading to the Ganges, where Ramananda would go every morning to bathe, every morning before sunrise. And so when Ramananda came down, he stepped on Kabir, Ramananda shouted, "Ha Ram," "Oh Ram," as sort of a purification. And Kabir said, "Ah, now you've given me the mantra. Now I'm your disciple." And then, that's the story of told in Kabir, the Kabir Panthi, the tradition of Kabir and Kabir hagiographies. Kabir is a very difficult figure when we think of this sort of Hindu and Muslim. He has a Muslim background, is said to have been initiated by a prominent Hindu ascetic. After his death, both Muslims and Hindus claimed him as their own. And to make things even more complicated, the tradition of Sikhism, a lot of the sacred texts of the Sikhs, the Guru Granth, consists of poems of Kabir, so he's kind of incorporated into that tradition as well. So he has sort of these multiple groups claiming ownership of him in some ways. But as we will see in his own writings, he constantly says, "I'm neither of these." He constantly mocks both Hindus and Muslims. He constantly says that Hindus and Muslims are both deluded and have misunderstood everything, and do not know God, and so on. So a lot of the other Psalms are more clearly sort of Hindu, you could say, and have a stronger Hindu identity, in that their focus is on the devotion to Ram or devotion to Krishna. As we will see, Kabir is although he constantly talks about Ram, his understanding of that is very different from the understanding of sort of the Ram Bhakti that develops in North India. But we'll come back to that in a moment. But a lot of the other poets are focused on a particular deity or a particular sort of tradition of devotional thought, most of which is Vaishnava in nature. And so you have two sort of main worship, sort of focus of worship. Some are devoted to Ram and write poems in praise of Ram. Some write poems in praise of Krishna. And then you have in Maharashtra, Marathi poets who are considered saints as well, who write poetry in praise of Krishna, but specifically in praise of a deity called Vithal, who is worshipped in Pandharpur. And there's a strong... and Vithal's identity is a little problematic, or sort of a little complicated. A prominent Maharashtrian scholar, whose name I forget now, not too long ago wrote a very lengthy or a very sort of detailed book on the history of Vithal, where he shows that kind of in early stages, Vithal was worshipped as Shiva, actually, and then kind of has a transition to sort of becomes a Vaishnava deity. But the around Vithal and around Pandharpur, that place, you get a group of poets who are writing poetry in praise of Vithal in a Vaishnava sense, seeing Vithal as a Vaishnava deity. Now, to complicate matters further, so we have kind of different objects of devotion, mostly Vaishnava in orientation, but that's kind of only part of the sense. And you have... order this. Let's do it here. Sorry. You find the common distinction that is made between the sons, between two groups of sons, whether they're nirguna or saguna. And these are terms that become particularly prominent here in sort of North India in the sense that they're now most used. Where nirguna means without qualities, where God is considered to be having no attributes, and as opposed to the saguna poets, who are poets who see, who sort of conceive of God as possessing qualities, as possessing attributes. And it's a distinction that's very commonly made, that we see is made already from the 7th century onwards, in anthologies of their poetry, but it's a distinction that's a little difficult to uphold in some ways. So generally, here under the saguna category, we have the poets who praise Krishna and Ram, who, you know, they conceive of God as having these qualities, as Krishna has qualities, and so on, and Ram. And so you get, for example, poets like Mirabai, a female a poet who's a devotee of Krishna, and for Ram, you get the most prominent one would be Tulsidas, who writes poems in praise of Ram and is most known for this very sort of, you know, long retelling of the Ramayana, the Ramcharitmanas, which is still very popular, perhaps more popular than the Sanskrit Ramayana in the Hindi-speaking world. And on the other hand, you would have nirguna poets, poets who argue that God has no qualities, like, for example, we'll speak of Kabir mostly today. Now, the reason this sort of division is a little difficult... let's add one other here. Suardas. is because if you look at these the individual poems of these poets, they don't always fit so neatly into either category. Sur Das, for example, he's a very still very popular Krishna devotee. His songs are still sung by many temples and by many devotees. And he's often sort of said, okay, well, he's clearly a saguna bhakta, but some of his poems actually sort of have more of a nirguna sort of flavor, and established kind of, you know, would fall into this category. And some of the poets in this category kind of have poets and poems in the other, and so on. So it's a little difficult to kind of make that a very a hard distinction. But it's a useful distinction in a sense to kind of just think of it more broadly in the sense as a whole, even if individually, for individual sense, it doesn't quite hold up that neatly. And now, and so the anyway, what I want to say is that the sense are very diverse in sort of their in their general orientation, in their theological persuasions and so on. But they're also diverse in the sense that these different poets have very different influences on them, but also get incorporated into different traditions. And some, like Kabir, are the, in a sense, sort of the founders of their own traditions, and you have the Kabir Pantis, the followers of Kabir, who still exist up until this day, which is kind of its own tradition that develops. And a lot of the Nirguna poets have sort of their own traditions in that way. Others, like, for example, Sur Das, gets incorporated into the tradition of Vallabha that we'll look at next week, a Krishna devotional tradition that emerges in the 16th century, where Sur Das is by the Vallabha tradition seen as a disciple of Vallabha, and his poems are immensely important for that tradition. And so they get incorporated into some traditions. In some cases, they form their own traditions. In other cases, they don't really have a distinct sort of following, in a sense, and they're more sort of popular songs, like Mirabai, for example. Her songs are popular, but it's not that sort of any one tradition has a unique claim on her or sort of claims her as her own, nor does she start her own tradition in a sense. Now, to add one other layer of complication to thinking of the sants as a group is that this is a tradition that whose literature consists primarily of songs that are performed, that are sung in congregation, that therefore has a strong oral culture. But these songs were also written then, and so we have manuscript sort of histories of these texts, of their poems, and we have from, you know, from fairly early on, we have anthologies of sant poems and so on. Now, if you look at sort of the anthology that they develop, the later the anthologies, the more songs you have. And so you have, like Mirabai in the earliest anthologies has less than 20 songs to her name. Nowadays you can buy, you know, sort of a collection of Mirabai poems and you'll have hundreds of them in there. And the same with Sur Das and the same with Tulsi Das and Kabir and so on. Because what happened in sort of subsequent centuries after these people live is other poets would continue to write poems in their tradition, as it were, and they would sign their poems with the name of the poet they're emulating. And so you have people writing in the 17th century who would be writing poems of Kabir, who lived in the 14th century, and sign it with Kabir, and that's kind of it's sort of seen as this is a poem in the style of Kabir, and therefore I can put the signature of Kabir on there. As we will see, each of those poets has signs their poetry with their name in generally the last line or the penultimate line. So anyway, that kind of complicates it too, and sort of, you know, which Mirabai are we talking about? Are we talking about the, you know, whatever we might know of the historical Mirabai who lived and wrote certain poems, or are we talking about the Mirabai of the tradition where a whole bunch of poems are ascribed to her, and sort of Mirabai in, you know, the way 18th century Bhakta's C. Mirabai is very different from the way, you know, 16th century or early 17th century devotees might have seen Mirabai, just because the corpus of Mirabai's poems has grown substantially in those centuries. And so are we talking about the Mirabai that they know, or are we talking about a quote-unquote sort of historical Mirabai and kind of trying to reconstruct what Mirabai actually might have written and so on? So that's kind of an added complication to all this. Now, the sants is a collective term that is used to refer to all these poets, and it's really it's a term that's sometimes used in a very, very broad sense as referring to any poet writing in the vernacular in North India, from Bengal to Gujarat, to Maharashtra in the south, to the Punjab, and Kashmir even. But really, most generally, it is used in a narrower sense to refer primarily to the poets in the Hindi belt, sort of the Hindi-speaking region, and Maharashtra. And it's those two languages, early forms of Hindi, Hindustani, Braj Bhasha, and so on, and Marathi, that form the sort of the basis of this. Even though, as we've seen, sort of the theology is very different, and the sort of leanings, devotional leanings of these poets is very diverse. It's kind of the language sort of unites them, and and that's kind of why they're often sort of labeled as sants. Now, in terms of influences, these sants also have, there's a lot of different streams of thought that come together in them, or that sort of show there's sort of a lot of ideas from various traditions that we see surfacing in the poetry of the sants. Some of these have very strong Islamic influence, particularly in sort of conceiving of God as Nirguna, which is, it's quite differently conceived than for example Shankara would conceive it. You have poets who see God as having no attributes, but as still being different from the individual self, unlike Advaita Vedanta or Kashmir Shaivism and so on that we've seen before. But you can sort of see a strong Islamic influence on there from Sufi Islamic traditions that are popular in these regions at the same time. And but we also see, as we've seen, a lot of Vaishnava influence. There's also some Shaiva influence on them in the form of a Shaiva tradition that develops called the Nath Yogis. It's a yogic tradition, which is a tantric yogic tradition that a lot of terminology from those surfaces in these poems. And so it's obvious there's a strong influence of them on this. Some of the technical terminology that Nath Yogis use is used by Kabir, for example. And so it's really this sort of confluence of different traditions in the poetry of these sants that then leads to kind of this flourishing of new devotional ideas that are building on all of these earlier ideas, but are yet distinct from them, and start kind of as in some cases in Kabir, start their own tradition. Now, one of the other things that the sants all have in common is their general attitudes towards caste. A large number of sant poets are from lower caste backgrounds. You have Dalits among them, you have letter workers and weavers and sweepers and so on, who are kind of, you know, really outside of the Brahminical society that we've mostly been talking about so far. There's a number of women involved as well. Not that many, but there are some female saints. Mirabai is the most prominent one, who are kind of part of this. And there's an emphasis in their poetry on rejecting caste. Caste as being an imposition, a man-made creation, that's imposed on people to sort of, you know, oppress them or to keep them in place, as having nothing to do with any sort of notion of religion or any sort of understanding of the divine. And just to give you a flavor of this, you have a poem there on the bottom of the handout by a poet called Ravidas, anyway, we'll read it and you'll get a flavor and you'll see something of how he sees himself. He says, a family that has a true follower of the Lord is neither high caste nor low caste, lordly or poor. The world will know it by its fragrance. Priests or merchants, laborers or warriors, half-breeds, outcasts, and those who tend cremation fires, their hearts are all the same. He who becomes pure through love of the Lord exalts himself and his family as well. Thanks be to his village, thanks to his home, thanks to that pure family, each and every one, for he's drunk with the essence of the liquid of life, and he pours away all the poisons. No one equals someone so pure and devoted, not priests, not heroes, not parasoled kings. As the lotus leaf floats above the water, Ravidas says, so he flowers above the world of his birth. And so we get the notion, you know, so thanks be to his village, thanks to his home and so on, that a person, even from a very low caste, will purify the sort of, you know, there's no consideration of caste in such a person. That person that becomes a pure family because of the fragrance, as he puts it, of someone who is pure through love of the Lord. And so this is a common theme in their poems. You have a number of Brahmin sons as well, and they will have the same attitude. There's an emphasis on God, and the proximity to God and your devotion to God is the most important thing, and caste has no consideration in that. So a Brahmin devotee a Dalit devotee should hang out with each other, should be in proximity, you know, should interact with each other because of their devotion to God. And there should be no consideration. And so there's a sense that the devotional community is a separate community, sort of a new community that is created where everyone is equal before God. And the only thing that matters is one's devotion. The same, and we see this in other devotional traditions, but here there's a stronger emphasis on this. Other devotional traditions, often Sanskritic devotional traditions, often have the attitude where it is, if principles of Dharma in terms of Dharma Shastra conflict with devotional principles, then devotional principles are more important. And so if a Brahmin, if a Dalit becomes a great devotee in a Shaiva or a Vaishnava tradition, then a Brahmin should seek that person's company. And so their bhakti is the more important thing that trumps Dharma, considerations of Dharma. However, most of these other traditions will argue that, you know, if the Dalit is not a devotee, then the Brahmin should stay away from that person, should maintain the rules of Dharma. So this is kind of the general attitude in other devotional traditions. But here that's entirely rejected. It caste in and of itself is rejected, not just when it conflicts with devotional principles, but in all respects, it is not to be taken into consideration. And so that's something quite new. The other thing that you get emphasized with this is in a sense linked to this, and that is the emphasis on experience, on direct experience. And we've not seen that in the earlier traditions we've looked at so far, where experience is talked about. Of course, you know, there are experiences you get of God through meditation, through devotional practice, through tantric practice, and so on. But the way experience is thought about in most other traditions is experience is that which is guided by scripture. And so we have the text, and the text is the guide to your experience. And your experience is only valid insofar as it corresponds to the textual tradition that you're following. And so it's kind of very much rooted in scripture, very much rooted in text, that through practice you're trying to sort of internalize and embody. Here, a lot of these poets are from low caste backgrounds who have no access to Sanskrit education, who are prevented or sort of not allowed to study the Upanishads and so on, and the Vedic text, but who would not have the education either to study some of the other texts that we've seen, like the Tantric text and so on, which are in Sanskrit. And so there is that sense that textual knowledge is actually something that can be very harmful in your spiritual progress. And we'll see there's a lot of ridiculing of scholars, whether Muslim or Hindu, who are spending all their time studying these texts, which are pretty much everyone that we've looked at so far. And instead, in contrast to that, is the emphasis is given on experience, on direct experience of the divine, which they would emphasize is, to use a term Kabir uses often, is sahaja, or sahaj, which is innate, which is naturally obtained. And so there's a sense that the divine is within everyone. We all carry God within us. And so it is not difficult to attain God, but people have made it really complicated in their various religious systems that they've developed. But if through devotion we're able to turn to God who resides within us, then you know we can attain direct experience of the nature of God, and through that attain liberation. And so this is something that's in its emphasis, at least, is very new in this period. And it's something that becomes very important for the development of modern forms of Hinduism, where this becomes the emphasis as well, not scripture, but direct experience as being the more important means where scripture comes to be seen as the outcome of individuals' experience, rather than sort of that which generates the experience, as it were. And so that's kind of that's what a lot of these poets have in common, particularly the Nirguna ones will emphasize the importance of experience as sort of finding God within. The Saguna poets will emphasize this too, but more emphasize it in sort of the way that bhakti is sort of practiced in Vaishnava traditions more generally, but will do that sort of without reference to the importance of the study of scripture. In terms of theology, you will not find sort of very developed theological arguments in these traditions or in these poets. They have their theological convictions, of course, as we will see in some of the poems we'll read in a moment. But they're not interested in writing theological treatises, as we've seen, you know, someone like Shankara or Ramanuja or Abhinavagupta or any of the other persons we've looked at so far are sort of interested in laying out their theological arguments and often do so in response to other schools and so on. These are poets. They don't care about doing this. For them, the experience of God is not found in debates, is not found in theological reasoning, but it's found in the direct experience of bhakti, which is most commonly practiced in congregation through the singing of songs and through the recitation of God's name. And this is the key practice for a lot of these. It's the emphasis on the name of God as reciting that. Now, the name of God for Saguna poets or poets who sort of are explicitly Vaishnava in nature would be the name of the deity they're worshipping. For Nirguna poets, they will often use the name Ram, and we've seen kind of, you know, Kabir is said to be initiated by Ramananda and have received the name Ram. And we'll see this Kabir is often talking about, you know, chanting the name of Ram, but what he means by Ram is not Ram of the Ramayana, Ram of, you know, the prince of Ayodhya, but it's rather, it's just an abstract name in a sense for God. that through that meditation on the name of God, you can come, you obtain not the Rama, the Ramayana, but the Nirguna nature of God. And just to give you a sense of their sort of style, I thought I've given you quite a few poems there of Kabir. And the reason I've emphasized Kabir in the handout is because a lot of the other poems, particularly if you read like Mirabai or Sur Das or Tulsi Das, it's fairly similar in their expressions of bhakti. They're fairly similar to a lot of the bhakti we've seen before. They're addressing God, they're addressing Krishna or Ram, sort of expressing their desire to for devotion or describing the beauty of Ram or the beauty of Krishna or some of the leelas of them. But what is different about Kabir is that Kabir will often address not God, but other human beings, and you get a tone that's very different from the other poets because of that. And the poems you have here are of Kabir are almost all from a collection of Kabir's poem called the Bijak. And the Bijak sort of presents an aspect of Kabir that's very different from other poems of Kabir, and it's basically we have sort of three different types of Kabir. If you look at the sort of poems that are there, we have the Kabir that is integrated into the Adi Granth of the Sikhs, which is sort of a very devotional Kabir, a Kabir who expresses his love for God, and is kind of fairly similar to a lot of the other poets. We have a Kabir, so there's another collection of poems of Kabir, where Kabir is more sort of the ecstatic mystic who describes his sort of ecstatic experiences of union with God. And then we have the Kabir of the Bijak, which is the sarcastic Kabir, and it's the harsh Kabir, and it's the Kabir who's mocking everyone, and who doesn't hesitate to call people, to insult people. You have this at the bottom of page 2 of the handout. You have sort of an example of there from the Bijak, where he says, "Son of a slut, there, I've insulted you. Think about getting on the good road." And this is quite typical for a Kabir in the Bijak, where he'll call his audience names and he'll insult them to get their attention. And then he'll start teaching, saying what he has to say. But just in some of the time that remain, I think if we look at some of the poems, you'll get a better sense of the nature of devotion that Kabir is teaching, of the way he understands God, but also the way he thinks of Hindu and Muslim, and the way he positions himself in between those. So if you look at the handout, you have there two... on page 2, it says God's name. So he says, "Go naked if you want. Put on animal skins. What does it matter till you see the inward Ram, till you see God who resides within? If the union yogi Sikh came from roaming about in the buff, every deer in the forest would be saved. If shaving your head spelled spiritual success, heaven would be filled with sheep. And brother, if holding back your seat, being celibate, earned you a place in paradise, eunuchs would be the first to arrive." Kabir says, "Listen, brother, without the name of Ram, who has ever won the spirit's prize?" And so it's kind of, this is very typical of him, sort of mocking religious practices that are pursued here. Here he's targeting the yogis who practice celibacy, who, you know, wear animal skins and so on, who shave their head, and as saying, what's the value in any of this? If you do not have devotion to the name of Ram, if you do not sort of focus on the on God who resides within, who's easily obtained, then what benefit is there? Okay, let's see. But if you look at the next section, a lot of these poems there are mocking Hindu and Muslim practices. And if you look at sort of the second column at the very bottom, it says, "Pandit, how can you be so dumb? He says, Pandit, how can you be so dumb? You're going to drown along with all your kin unless you start speaking of Ram. Vedas, Puranas, why read them? It's like loading an ass with sandalwood. You know, it's an old image that's used in Sanskrit texts as well to mock the learning of ignorant people, where, you know, they memorize the texts, but they do not understand what these texts are actually saying. And so they're like the ass that carries the sandalwood, which has a very sweet, fine fragrance, but the ass just feels the weight and cannot appreciate the fragrance because he's just sort of burdened with the wood. So it's like loading an ass with sandalwood. Unless you catch on and learn how Ram's name goes, how will you reach the end of the road? You slaughter living beings and call it religion. Hey, brother, what would irreligion be? Great saint, that's how you love to greet each other. Who then would you call a murderer? Your mind is blind. You have no knowledge of yourselves. Tell me, brother, how can you teach anyone else? Wisdom is a thing you sell for worldly gain. So there goes your human birth in vain. You say, it's Narada's command. It's what Vyasa says to do. Go and ask Shukadev, the sage. And these are all figures very prominent in Puranic texts. Kabir says, you'd better go and lose yourself in Ram, for without him, brother, you drown. You drown in the ocean of samsara, in the ocean of rebirth. And if you look at the next one, where he says, saints, I see the world is mad. If I tell the truth, they rush to beat me. If I lie, they trust me. I've seen the pious Hindus, rule followers, early morning bath takers, killing souls. They worship rocks. And this is very typical of Kabir. He's very, and this is sort of, scholars have argued sort of, you can so clearly see the Islamic influence there. He's against the worship of Murtis, which someone like Surdas and Mirabai and so on are definitely not, but Kabir is. They know nothing. I've seen plenty of Muslim teachers, holy men, reading their holy books and teaching their pupils techniques, teaching them spiritual practices. They know just as much. And posturing yogis, hypocrites, hearts crammed with pride, praying to brass, to stones, reeling with pride in their pilgrimage, fixing their caps and their prayer beads, painting their brow marks and arm marks, having the tilaka marks of sectarian sort of designations that sadhus would have, and Vaishnavas and Shaivas have, and so on, the marks on the forehead and on the upper arms and the upper body. Braying their hymns and their couplets, reeling, they never heard of soul. The Hindus say Ram is beloved, the Turk says, the Muslim says Rahim, then they kill each other. No one knows the secret. They buzz their mantras from house to house, puffed with pride. The pupils drown along with their gurus. In the end, they're sorry. Kabir says, listen, saints, they are all deluded. Whatever I say, nobody gets it. It's too simple. And so that's kind of his idea. You know, it's so simple that nobody can understand it, and therefore everyone kind of comes up with all their complex practices, with all their theological arguments, with all their sacred texts, and then they start fighting with each other and arguing with each other and seeing themselves as different in some way. I like the
it's
next one.
Funny.
He's sharp. I mean, he's and he doesn't. Yeah, he doesn't shy away from mocking people or calling them bad names even.
Does somebody go into some part of hearing? Are they just features of the translation, or are they just accidental?
Sorry.
There's a tendency for like the occasional rhymes, but there's no consistent type rhyme scheme. Why is assuming that's just a feature of the translation?
Yeah.
Or is that just coincidental?
A lot of these vernacular poems would have rhymes. They're sung, and so they have end rhymes. The translation didn't preserve that. So if there is a rhyme,
it's not a translator thinking, I'll put a rhyme here, it's just coincidence.
It's not that Kabir has only a rhyme at those places. They would all rhyme. Yeah.
I knew it would be original.
Yeah.
Who has translated this?
This is a translation by a lady called Linda Hess, who's one of the foremost Kabir scholars of today. She's kind of adopted into, she's the adopted brother, she became the adopted brother of one of the foremost Kabir singers today. She's kind of spent years and years with these Kabir followers and sort of really imbibed that mood. If you meet her, she's a wonderful lady. And she's really like a you know, when she gets going, you can sort of feel the sort of Kabir coming out of her because she's immersed herself so deeply in this. So that's her translation. And when she kind of does use a harsh word, it's because Kabir does that as well. So in that other one, like son of a slut, this is Kabir is using very harsh language there, so she kind of preserves that.
So would it be originally in Urdu or Arabic?
No, these would be in an early form of Hindi. Or the next one I quite like. It says, Qazi, which is the Muslim scholar, what book are you lecturing on? Yuck, 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 day and night, you never had an original thought. Feeling your power, you circumcise. I can't go along with that, brother. If your God favored circumcision, then why then didn't you come out cut? If circumcision makes you a Muslim, what then do you call your woman? Since women are called men's other half, you might as well be Hindus. If putting on the sacred thread makes you Brahmin, what does the wife put on thee? Female Brahmins don't wear a thread. So if the thread makes you a Brahmin, then what is your woman? She must be a shudra. That shudra is touching your food, Pandit. You know, your wife, who's a shudra, is cooking your food, so you become impure because of that. Who started this road? Look hard in your heart. Send out scouts. Where is heaven? Now you get your way by force. But when it's time for dying, without Ram's refuge, says Kabir, brother, you'll go out crying. Maybe just to end the last one you have there. So saints, when he's saying saints, he's addressing the sant, he's addressing the community of bhaktas. So it's kind of typical of Kabir. Sometimes he's addressing them, sometimes he's addressing Muslims and Hindus who are not part of the community. So saints, I've seen both ways. Hindus and Muslims don't want discipline. They want tasty food. The Hindu keeps the 11th day fast, the Ekadashi fast, which is a fasting on the 11th day of the waxing and the waning moon, particularly Vaishnavas will fast from grains. They will not eat any grains. And so the Hindu keeps the 11th day fast, eating chestnuts and milk. He curbs his grain, but not his brain, and breaks his fast with meat. The Turk prays daily, fast once a year during Ramadan, and crows, God, God, like a cock. What heaven is reserved for people who kill chickens in the dark? For kindness and compassion, they've cast out all desire. One kills with a chop, the Hindu. One lets the blood drop, the Muslim. In both houses burns the same fire. Turks and Hindus have one way. The Guru's made it clear. Don't say Ram, don't say Khuda, so says Kabir. So here, Ram and Khuda as being Hindu and Muslim names for God. Don't think in those two terms. There you have a little taster of Kabir. Kabir is still immensely popular, pretty much anyone from the Hindi-speaking region will know some of Kabir's songs and some of his doha, some of his sayings and so on. His influences went way beyond the Kabir Panthis, the sort of tradition he established. And you can sort of see why, in a sense, you know, he's teaching a certain theology in a way, but it's not very sort of dense in it. You can be from a variety of traditions or a variety of theological persuasions and have some affinity with what he's saying, because he's not so you know, doctrinally dense in a sense. But Anyway, I'll leave it at that.